Welcome to another edition of Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein. When you meet such accomplished women as my guest today, introductions can be overwhelming. What to include, what to leave out, so I'll do my best. Filmmaker Fern Perlstein is also a writer, director, producer, cinematographer, editor, whose work has won numerous awards and has been shown nationally and internationally. Her most recent feature is the documentary The Last Laugh, which features Mel Brooks, Carl and Rob Reiner, Sarah Silverman, Judy Gold, Harry Shearer, Susie Essman, and Auschwitz survivor Renee Firestone. And it includes rare archival footage of cabarets in concentration camps. The film explores what is and is not off limits in comedy. The Last Laugh had its world premiere at the 2016 Tribeca Film Festival and has been playing all over the place. Fern's 2003 doc, Sumo East and West, which she directed, produced, photographed, and edited, also premiered at Tribeca, LA, and Melbourne film festivals and was broadcast on Independent Lens and international TV. The film follows foreigners who take up the ancient Japanese sport of sumo wrestling. A year later, she won the Excellence in Cinematography Prize at Sundance for her work on Imelda. Fern lived and traveled with the Philippines' former First Lady during her campaign for the presidency. In 2002, she was hired by director Robert Edwards to shoot the film The Voice of the Prophet. They got married, and they've been producing partners ever since. Fern has postgraduate degrees in documentary film from Stanford and in photography from the International Center of Photography. So let's meet this one-woman band. Fern, welcome, and thanks for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
So I read that you wanted to be a documentary photographer. A, was that always your career goal? And isn't that just being a photojournalist?
It wasn't always my goal. I had gone to college thinking I was going to be a lawyer, a criminal lawyer, or like a public defender. And it sort of came to me at the end of at the time where I was starting to think about law school and getting ready for that, when all of a sudden, you know, I sort of woke up one morning and decided I wanted to be a photographer. And there is a difference between photojournalism and documentary photography. My teacher at the International Center of Photography, her name was Joan Lifton, and I loved how she put it. She used to say that the difference between photojournalism and documentary photography is if somebody jumps off the side of a building,
yeah,
the photojournalist takes the picture of the person falling midair. The documentary photographer takes pictures of all the people watching with their mouths open wide.
Okay. But did you have a bent for photography growing up?
I did not.
So that's weird, right? To go from...
Well, you know, I was always wanted to be an artist as a kid. I was sort of pushed in the direction of, you know, no, be a lawyer or a doctor. I sort of put that other stuff aside. Mm-hmm. I had lived in Spain a semester in college. You know, I had a cheapy little pocket camera, and I just really enjoyed it. And I remember my mother, while I was in Spain, was helping me fill out an application for a summer job, you know, for, you know, some political organization. And I remember while she was writing down what I had said, and I was like, you know, in a moment between thoughts, I said, you know, I think when I'm in law school, I'm going to take photojournalism classes on the side. And she had the same reaction to me as you just did. And then I put it out of my head. And when I was getting to that point where, am I going to be a lawyer? This is not for me. It just came to me. I cannot explain it any other way. And I remember seeing this advertisement for something at the New School in Parsons, which was a week-long, intensive documentary photography / photojournalism course. And I did it. It was an intensive week-long thing. And at the end of the week, with all the students, there was a prize for one of the students, and I won it.
No kidding.
And I had the least experience of anyone because I had just picked up a camera for the first time 6 months before.
So maybe it was a natural act.
I like to say it just came to me, like something sort of...
Yeah, and I accept that. Do you earn a living as a documentary photographer?
No. I went to the International Center of Photography.
Which is also in Manhattan.
Way back when. Mm-hmm. The year I finished at ICP, a friend of mine jokes that this was the best entry-level position in New York City at the time, but I used to do paste-up on Monday nights at 6 p.m. through the night at the Village Voice, doing the pasting up the classifieds with rubber cement and a you know, box cutter.
You were really in the trenches then, weren't you? Yeah.
But we were the first people to see the listings.
Mm-hmm.
So I got a great apartment. And I got a job working for two Japanese journalists who were the New York bureau chiefs and needed somebody to sit in the office and answer phones. I came in, they spoke barely any English. They knew words like photojournalist, Village Voice, and I got the job. I started the next day, and the first part of my job was answering the 500 calls for the people who were calling about the job because the paper came out after I got the job.
Isn't that crazy?
And then, really, they just wanted somebody in the office because of their deadlines were at midnight, and they needed somebody inside the office during the day. The one boss took me under his wing, and he made me a photojournalist. So I have tons and tons of photos that have been published in Japan, in the fourth largest paper in Japan, but have published nowhere
else. Yeah. Oh, that's great. What was the trajectory from going from photography to cinematography?
Okay, so really it was actually an accident. So I had been working, you know, at the Japanese newspapers, but I knew that that was temporary because his work was temporary. His work in New York was temporary.
Okay.
In the meantime, my roommate and very good friend was looking into grad school for herself. She was a photographer. She had been working at Magnum Photos as a photo researcher. And as she was looking into programs, I started helping her and reading about them. And then I accidentally
The Village Voice. Yeah.
I accidentally came across this documentary film program at Stanford that was set up very similarly to the program I had gone to at ICP. It was a very small, intimate program, about 10 people, give or take. You learn every aspect of documentary.
Mm-hmm,
and I thought, well, this is a better way. This opens up my possibilities for documentary. That's what drew me to it. Originally, it was a small documentary program where they took people who had no filmmaking experience. The fact that I had photography experience
kind of worked against you a little bit.
A little bit.
Gotcha.
Uh-huh. So they wanted, you had a career in science, you'd be great. You'll make science documentaries. You were interested in such and such.
Got it.
So the photography thing for me was
a little iffy, huh?
A little iffy, but I got in, which was incredible. And then I just naturally started shooting people's films because I had, in the end, not that much more knowledge, but I had a trained eye.
And it was more of a natural act for you.
Yeah, it was. It was. In fact, when I first pitched something to one of the head professors, I had this idea for a compilation film.
Mm-hmm.
It was going to be found footage and, you know, because I'm as much into editing as I am into shooting. And he said to me, what a shame. We have one student that has a photography background and they're not going to shoot their own project. And when he said that, I thought, wow. And that was the moment I realized, oh, I'm supposed to be a cinematographer, which was great because that's how I could make a living. I couldn't make a living as a documentary photographer. I couldn't make one as a director yet.
Mm-hmm.
And so
So that was the road you were going to travel.
Exactly.
If you're just joining us, my guest today is Fern Perlstein, an American filmmaker who is a rare triple threat, a prize-winning cinematographer, feature film editor, writer, director. Was it difficult to get on that road of what? Making your own documentaries? What is it that you wanted to do?
Okay, so the great thing about the program, and because I was in an earlier iteration of the program, you know, it was 1 year of coursework for me, and then you were sort of out on your own to make an independent film.
Sure.
So it was an incredible experience. At the time, I did my 1 year of coursework. I came back to the East Coast with an old boyfriend of mine who I met in the program. We created work for ourselves. We made a, you know, sort of a documentary for hire. We approached a company and made a film about hospice.
And you sold it?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Well, we sold it to them and then made it.
Uh-huh.
So then we went back to Stanford to finish our thesis films.
Mm-hmm.
And then immediately I started getting cinematography work as I was finishing my film.
How great is
that? So it was a job I couldn't say no to, even though I had been planning to come back east.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, once that project became freelance enough that I didn't need to be based in California, I still worked on it, but I was able to come back to New York.
What years are we talking about?
I moved out there in 91. Mm-hmm. That was my first year there. Mm-hmm. And then I was there until 95.
Okay.
And, you know, a lot of people will say, was it hard because you're a woman? And in some ways, it was my career began because I was a woman. I was in the right place. There were so many films that in San Francisco being made about sensitive topics where they either wanted a woman to shoot it, or whether it was just for their, like, it'd be easier to raise the money if a woman was shooting.
That's really interesting.
So
to
I
me.
Was up for jobs against based a lot of, like,
on
you know, yeah, but
I was up against
some really incredible, like, men who've been doing it for years and years and years. And then I became friendly with them, and then they would recommend me for stuff. And so my career kicked off because I was a woman.
Isn't that amazing?
In cinematography. And then, what they call it, the Stanford Mafia. Even moving back here, most of the work I got in the next, I don't know how many years, was based on those connections.
Which you cultivated, and you obviously were able to meet the requirements, you know, and you had the creativity, and you had the street cred, and you
right.
had the skills.
I mean, I got the work. Hopefully, you know, that's how I kept getting the work.
Well, whatever opens the door, and then you've got to prove yourself.
Right.
No kidding. Talk about your projects.
The beginning of my career really started as a cinematographer. I was shooting in film, which even at the time was a unique thing, even though it was more prevalent.
But cinematography only through documentaries or features?
No, at this point, I had never shot any narrative stuff, only documentaries.
Okay.
And I got great advice from an old professor, John Els, who is a fantastic director and cinematographer. And he told me, if you want to shoot in film, you want people to hire you to shoot in film, you got to buy a camera. And I did. And I was able to convince most of the people I was working with to shoot their documentaries and film, which was, like I said, it was still unique because people were like, digital was just taking off. You know, it was the mid-90s. Like,
so this was kind of old school?
It was a little old school now. Now it's almost unheard of,
right.
Although I'm still doing it. But it made me a little different than the other cinematographers.
Uh-huh.
And I was never, you know, so into the changing cameras, you know, the digital changing cameras that I didn't love exactly. And I didn't love keeping up with all those. And I still don't.
Mm-hmm.
I you know, it just doesn't interest me. And also the thought process that goes in when you're shooting in film, because you have to be, you have to shoot with more constraints.
Mm-hmm.
And my brain works better doing it that way. So I started doing that. I was working for a lot of people, but I still shot tons of stuff digitally as well. And I was getting more and more frustrated, you know, that I wanted to be able to edit the footage and I wanted to be able to, you know, direct the footage. And along the way, two important projects that came up before I started making my sumo film was a documentary that I was a co-director on and that I edited with Josh Taylor. He's the grandson of the heir apparent of Bergdorf Goodman.
Oh.
And the film was called Dita and the Family Business.
Mm-hmm.
And she's this, Dita, his grandmother, is this wonderful Cuban woman with, you know, and all her incredible stories. And he was able to film her before she died. And that was the first documentary I didn't shoot. So that was a really interesting experience
for me. So that also fleshes out another...
Yeah, it's the only thing like that till this day, except for when I've directed Second Unit for my husband's film. And while that was happening, Ramona Diaz, who directed Imelda, who was a classmate of mine at Stanford, she was raising money for Imelda.
And
we knew since I finished my thesis film at Stanford, we knew we were going to work together.
So she hired you.
Yes, but it was like a when we get the money kind
yes,
of thing.
I understand.
And my deal is while I was editing this film is at any point when that shoot starts, I'm disappearing.
Mm-hmm.
And it happened mid-editing Dita.
Mm-hmm.
We got money and we went and we spent a month
in the Philippines. Very cool.
And it was really incredible.
I'd like to move into The Last Laugh.
Okay.
Because that's a big deal.
Yeah.
I mean, not that your other films have not been, but this screams out, in a sense, about this concept of that maybe nobody ever really thought about taboos in comedy. Where did this come from? Did you give birth to this?
Not exactly, but partially. When I was working for this Japanese newspaper that I told you about, the two bureau chiefs were invited to come to Miami. Let's give Miami a better name. It was, you know, 1990.
When I was kind of going to see.
Yeah. Come, you know, it was from the Miami Chamber of Commerce. Come and do this. And he looked at me and he said, I'm not going. You're going. You're going to do a photo essay on the drug
impact of drugs in
Miami, right. Which is not what the Chamber of Commerce was looking for.
You think?
And there were two spots. So I brought my friend Kent Kirschenbaum, just a very good friend of mine. So we went, and in the process of this, with all the other foreign journalists, we were the only Americans.
Your life should be documented.
One of the things was there was a brand new Holocaust memorial just built, and they took us to it. And the woman who, you know, gave us the tour was an elderly survivor. And at the very end, everybody went off on their own, and he and I continued to talk to her because we had just read Art Spiegelman's Mouse. Mm-hmm. Is basically the first graphic novel ever.
Ah.
It depicts his father's story, you know, going through Auschwitz, intercut with his troubled relationship with his father, and the Jews are all mice. It's the comic form, but it's not comic.
I hear you. Mm-hmm.
Although there are moments with him and his father, you know, dealing with the daily frustrations that have, that's where, you know, like, there's sort of a little release, you know, like a little bit of humor, dark humor. And so he said to her, have you read Art Spiegelman's Mouse? And she said, absolutely not. You know, it had won the Pulitzer Prize. She knew about it. Absolutely not. You cannot deal with the Holocaust through the funny pages. There's nothing funny about it.
Right.
And she was very offended. And he said, oh, no, there's nothing. It's not funny. It's just the comic form. And then he said, have you read it? And she said, no. And that really stayed with him. And we went off our separate ways. Then I went to Stanford. He went back to get his PhD in something totally unrelated. But in the process, took some random class and wrote this very academic paper called The Last Laugh, Humor in the Holocaust. And he handed me the paper. He said, make this into a movie. That was 1993.
And this is your friend?
Kent Kirschenbaum.
Right. So his was kind of the treatise for this.
Yes.
Down the road.
Absolutely.
Documentary.
He was thinking about it based on this conversation.
Got it. Mm-hmm.
And he knew, you know, we had very much a similar sense of humor and, you know, approach to these sorts of things. So it seemed like a perfect fit. That was 1993. I knew it was not going to be a film I could make right away. In 1998, I met my husband, who had hired me to shoot his film. By the end of the shoot, we were dating.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was that fast. And a month later, we were taking Kent's paper and trying to make it into a proposal.
That long ago?
In 1998.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Yes. So that was right before Life is Beautiful came out. And there was such an intense reaction. We thought, let's step back and, like, wait to see how this plays out. So there were times in between we revisited, but it was a very difficult film to get funding for. It was a very difficult film to get comedians to do.
What was the basis of it? What was the thrust of his paper?
Well, the thrust of his paper was a little different than the thrust of my film.
All right.
It's very academic. It mostly talks about the humor and documents the humor used in the camps, in the ghettos, around the war. It's a collection of jokes. It didn't do much post-war stuff. To me, it's the part of the story that makes it okay to make the film. You learn that Jewish people were making jokes themselves. And when I say jokes, it is not what we know of as jokes.
Take my wife, please.
Yes. It's not that. They're very subtle. It's like a form of storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, it was very hard to include some of those jokes in the film. Because people were like, well, that's not funny. That's not, like, that would be an interesting film in itself, like documenting the historical changes of jokes themselves.
Got it.
Just like Renee in my movie, who's the survivor who sometimes will make a dark joke or will laugh at something somebody else says. it gives you permission to laugh. Mm-hmm. I mean, something that Renee and I always talk about, it's easy for us to look at that history and look at that period and say, how could you laugh? Mm-hmm. How could you make jokes? How could you be in Auschwitz and say something funny?
Right.
But people had been persecuted for so long. This was part of their daily life. Oh, they were moved into a ghetto. Oh, they were, you know, on a train going. They didn't know they were going on a train to their deaths necessarily. It was in their, in a strange way, their everyday life.
Mm-hmm.
So
they're normal.
Yes. So if something funny happened, they would laugh mm-hmm. or chuckle or smile inside. You know,
it almost was, what a relief that you could still do that.
Right. But it's only in hindsight where we see that that was a big ending for people. But they weren't, they were in it. They
yes.
weren't like looking at it in hindsight.
If you're just joining us, my guest today is Fern Perlstein, an American filmmaker. Certainly, and I'm sure you've heard this a million times, you take your film, The Last Laugh, and you also take the Broadway show, you know, The Producers, Springtime for Hitler. Are you kidding? How can you do it? Whether you want it or not, they have to go in tandem because people would probably be saying it in the same breath, correct?
Oh, absolutely.
And that's not insulting anyway. How could you even entertain the idea of there's nothing funny about the Nazis or about Adolf Hitler. And so you took that as the basis for your film, The Holocaust?
As the starting point.
As the starting point.
Yeah. I mean, I wanted to definitely open it up to other topics that
sure.
are too dark to make humor about.
Like
or,
making
or very
fun
difficult.
Of somebody with a disability.
Well,
9/11. 9/11,
you know,
of
cancer,
course.
AIDS.
Right.
You know, we touch on all that stuff. So when he handed me this paper, and it was a very academic paper, I knew that we would have to interview certain people. Wouldn't it be interesting to interview comedians? And, you know, how could we make this film without Mel Brooks?
Mm-hmm,
how
of course.
Could we make it without, as time went on, without Sarah
Silverman? Right.
You know, there are certain people. So it became—
Who pushed the envelope.
Yeah. So it became, in my mind, a film about, you know, comedians or even authors who might have, you know, touched on humor. And then the wall I bumped up against was, you know, I had this cinematography background. I made observational films. I didn't know how to make a film that was just going to be talking heads and clips.
Uh-huh.
And I struggled for years. I knew I was going to find something. I knew it was going to feel like two different films I intercut together till it became one film. That's when I met Renee and she made that happen. It was important for me to find a survivor like Renee, who is an anti-genocide activist. She's not just, you know, never again the Holocaust. She's never again Rwanda, never again. You know, she was just in Rwanda on the eve of her 90th birthday,
mm-hmm.
you know, counseling survivors there.
So you were marrying the comics also with the topic.
We had a massive list of comics who dealt with taboo humor. We had people on that list we knew we had to have.
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, Mel Brooks, Sarah Silverman, had to have them. We weren't going to say no, you know, take no for an answer. We were going to find every possible way. There were other people we were disappointed that we couldn't get, but, you know, we found either other ways to include them in our film. Here's a great example. One of the first comedians to say yes was Joan Rivers.
Okay, not a surprise.
She was the busiest woman in the history of the planet.
Yeah, really.
So it was impossible to nail her down for a date. And how it would work is I'd get more money. I'd, you know, one comedian would say, yes, I'd build a shoot around it. And so then all the people on the list that were, yes, I can't now, but later, we'd contact them. Okay, we're going to be in Los Angeles. We're going to be in New York. Can you do it now? And it just didn't work out. And then finally, we pinned her down for the August right before she died.
Mm-hmm.
And they finally gave us a date. And it was September 15th if we did it in L.A., October 1st if in New York. And we opted for October 1st in New York. And she died.
Mm. You were obviously doing other things while you were making The Last Laugh, right?
Instead From the time I got the first tranche of money in the summer of 2011, that was my full-time job. But at the same time, I was a producer on my husband's film. Other than that, that's the only other thing
I did. So The Last Laugh is really quite a birthing, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Because, I mean, you're chief cook and bottle washer on this film, correct?
Yeah.
You did everything.
Yeah.
So this must be an amazing endeavor for you even today.
I'm stuttering because
I'm trying to put words to
what
the
you reactions must feel. To the film have been beyond my
wildest dreams.
Yes, comprehension, mm-hmm. I was going to say, but yes.
Mm-hmm.
The screenings have all been sold out. The most amazing part are the Q&As. People want to talk about it, mm-hmm. which is amazing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and where I've had these screenings. I went from Munich this summer, which was fascinating, directly to Jerusalem.
Wow. Oh my God.
Where I had one screening in the Cinematheque for the very festival crowd, and then the second screening was in an Orthodox neighborhood where everybody was Orthodox in the audience.
What was that experience like? As you look back and you think to yourself, man, this is one of the biggest things I've ever done.
It is. There's a little bit of a sense of peace, you know? It's the first time in my life or my career where instead of wanting to rush into the next thing, I'm wanting to enjoy.
Be washed, have this like, wash over
yes,
you.
Yes, wanting to like experience the screenings and the travel and the conversations about it. Whereas before, it was like, okay, back to work, you know. I might have gone to 3 of the festivals that my Sumo film was in, and that was at festivals for 1.5 years,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Do you have anything up your sleeve that you feel comfortable sharing?
You know, I actually have a couple of narrative scripts.
Mm-hmm. That you're going to be the director of?
Yes.
And wear more than one hat?
I'm ready to give up possibly shooting or editing.
Uh-huh.
I don't know. I'm a bit of a control
freak. You've been dancing,
freak.
But you've been dancing as fast
as
you can. That's a
somebody,
lot to do.
Somebody convinced me, you know, I mean, if somebody, like, proves that I don't, you know, if something.
I hear you.
Yeah.
Are you still working with your husband?
I am.
Uh-huh.
So we produce each other's films. We're
nice.
Creative producers, which is great. So when I say I was a producer on his film, which is now One More Time, but when it premiered at Tribeca 2 years ago, it was called When I Live My Life Over Again with Christopher Walken and Amber Heard. You know, it was. You know, that was a full-time job on top of the other. And, you know, it's a great relationship because we in some ways are so different and so complementary. You know, it's like I have a rock to rely on, and I hope to think he thinks the same.
What a great statement, because sometimes you could really be at loggerheads about that.
Yeah, we are.
Know?
And, you know, he did
when
a
you're
smart...
working with the person and sleeping with the person, that can really be very tough.
Well, you know, we met working together, so that helped.
Uh-huh.
But he made a very smart idea. He had a smart idea in the very beginning where he said, let's never co-direct. Let's always have it be one of our projects, which is great because our ideas for projects are very different. Our sensibilities are similar,
so
but our ideas—
you use your strengths.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, that's great.
The only time we broke that rule was we wrote a romantic comedy together. And we joked that because we edited 2 of our features together, his first narrative and my first documentary feature. And at the end of the day, if we were fighting over something, we could always say, well, look, I'm the boss. It's my project. When we were writing a script together, it was like co-directing, and we didn't have that difference. And to make it worse, he's a writer. He's a screenwriter. And I love to collaborate, and he doesn't love it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So he'd rather make the wrong decision than collaborate.
You know what? Maybe you guys should be the topic of a film. Think about
that. Well, the romantic comedy is a lot about our dynamic. So,
Fern, it was really nice to meet you and get to know
you.
And whether it was a struggle or not, you seemed to make it so easy. It's not a great feeling to know that you're doing what it is you should be doing and you want to do and you love doing.
Yes.
If I can put words in your
mouth.
Yes. That's great. Thank you so much
Thank
for
you.
Joining me today. Join us for another edition of Conversations with Creative Women, and please go to our iTunes store page and leave a rating and a review. And if you know anyone you think that we should interview, contact us at sandyklineshow.com.